Hello. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This is Frank Urban from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from Smithsonian.com. The magazine hasn't come in yet, so we're going online. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. And there's a lot of little shorter stories online, so we'll do that in lieu of the magazine. Meet the most important Jewish woman in medieval England. A new statue honors Le Corsia of Winchester, a 13th century moneylender whose life illuminates the challenges faced by Jews at the time. By Milan Solly. When Le Corsia of Winchester, an English moneylender who counted among her clients Henry III and members of his court, was found murdered in her home in 1277, news of her death circulated widely, even reaching Jewish communities in Germany. The level of interest generated by Le Corsia's killing reflected her unique position in medieval English society. She was Jewish, she was rich, and she was a woman, biographer Rebecca Abrams tells Catherine Pepinster of Religion News Service. All three might have led to her death. Now, approximately 745 years after Le Corsia's murder, amid a worrying uptick in anti-Semitism across Europe, a statue of the Jewish businesswoman is set to be installed in her home city of Winchester, where organizers hope it will promote tolerance and diversity in today's society while shedding light on an oft-overlooked chapter in local history. According to a statement sculpted by a British artist Ian Rank Broadley, the 6-foot-tall bronze statue depicts Le Corsia, whose name means sweet meat, holding the hand of her youngest son. The phrase, "Love thy neighbor as thyself," is engraved on the sculpture's stone plinth, P-L-I-N-T-H, in English and in Hebrew. In many ways, Le Corsia has always been there, and she's been hiding in historical documents and books, and it's the first time, if you like, that she has appeared in three dimensions on the streets of Winchester, where she lived, Rank Broadley tells Matthew Fraught of Jewish Chronicle. And, of course, there's a picture there of her. It's very nicely done, and it's kind of got that weathered look to it. Le Corsia, in the words of historian Robert Stacey, the most important Jewish woman in medieval England, she lived during a time of rampant anti-Semitism, when Jews were legally considered the personal property of the crown, a status that afforded them protection but left them vulnerable to heavy taxation. As Abrams wrote for History Extra in 2019, Jews made up just 0.25% of England's population at the end of the 12th century, but provided 8% of the royal treasury's total income. Jews also faced restrictions on what jobs they could pursue and found themselves subjected to prejudice on a daily basis. Money lending was a leading occupation for medieval Jews, as Christians viewed lending money for interest as a sin. Growing anti-Jewish sentiment sparked by the Crusades' false allegations of blood libel and financial instability culminated in Edward's expulsion of England's Jews in 1290. Born in the early 13th century, Le Corsia first appears in the historical record in 1234, when she was a young widow with three sons and possibly a daughter. Writing for the Jewish Woman's Archive, scholar Cheryl Talman and Suzanne Bartlett, author of a 2009 book on Lucrecia, note that she soon established herself as one of Winchester's wealthiest Jewish moneylenders. In 1242, Lucrecia wed her second husband, the similarly successful financier David of Oxford. When David died just 2 years later, Henry III had Lucrecia imprisoned in the Tower of London to prevent her from interfering with royal accounts, assessed his estate. Rather, to prevent her from interfering while royal accountants assessed his estate. According to a 2004 article in the Journal of Jewish Historical Studies, the Crown often seized one-third of deceased Jews' property as a relief or death duty. The king only authorized Lucrecia's release after adding 5,000 marks to the royal treasury, a substantial sum that went largely toward construction of a chapel at Westminster Abbey. The otherwise inauspicious event marked the beginning of Lucrecia's fruitful relationship with Henry, who supported her when she tried to reclaim debts and offered her an exemption from additional taxes, according to Historic Royal Places. JWA points out that Lucrecia's ease of access to the king also proved beneficial to the Jewish community, with other Jews relying on the moneylender to intercede with them on their behalf. The businesswoman loaned money to the elite, including the king and other members of the royal family, nobles, and the church, and less affluent members of society alike, offering financial aid to fellow Jews, small landowners, and farmers. Unfortunately for Lucrecia, her 1244 stint in the Tower wouldn't be her last. In 1258, a neighbor accused the moneylender of stealing a gold ring intended for the king. Lucrecia was sent to the Tower while the matter was investigated and only released after the neighbor who accused her was identified as the actual thief. In 1277, Lucrecia's daughter, Belia, discovered the body of her mother and a Christian servant, Alice of Bicton, in Lucrecia's Winchester home. Each had suffered a blow to the chest made by a knife to the heart, as one chronicler wrote at the time. Authorities indicted three suspects, believed to have attacked the women during a botched burglary or business transaction, but found the men not guilty, instead accusing a saddler who had left the city. Two of Lucrecia's sons attempted to bring a new case against the men, but were unsuccessful. Her murder was never officially solved. As Stephen Orszak reports for the Jewish News, Rank Broadley's statue of Lucrecia, scheduled to be unveiled by Prince Charles on February 10, presents her as a wealthy medieval woman, clad in ornate clothing and a headdress. Though most English Jews were required to wear badges denoting their religious identity, Lucrecia appears without one, as Jews with financial means could pay for an exemption from the regulation. In her right hand, the businesswoman holds a demand for tallage, or taxation, an allusion to the increased taxes leveled against English Jews throughout the 13th century. Her story epitomizes the prosperity and gradual decline of the Jewish community, which culminated in one of her sons being hanged for coin clipping and the others banished in the expulsion of the Jews from England, wrote Jonathan Romaine for the Jewish Chronicle in 2019. Jews were only readmitted to Britain in 1656, 366 years after their expulsion in 1290. And that article was written by Meilan, M-E-I-L-A-N, Solly, S-O-L-L-Y. And I have another story here. These, again, are little short stories from Smithsonian.com. More than 400 invasive fish dumped from aquariums found in Texas River. Plecos, or suckermouth armored catfish, are efficient algae-eating tank cleaners, but they are native to South America with few natural predators, by Margaret Osborne, contributor. Researchers from Texas A&M and Texas State University pulled 406 invasive suckermouth armored catfish from the San Marcos River in Texas earlier this month, per a Texas Parks and Wildlife Facebook post. The catfish, also called Plecotomus, it's a word I haven't seen before, P-L-E-C-O-S-T-O-M-U-S, or plecos, are native to South America, Panama, and Costa Rica, but were introduced into numerous water bodies in Texas after people dumped them in Texas after people dumped them from aquariums. The fish are popular strong aquarists because they eat algae in tanks. A lot of time people purchase plecos for their fish aquariums to clean the bottoms of the fish tank and the sides and keep algae out of the fish tanks, and they don't realize they can get up to 2 to 2.5 feet long, Melissa Bryant from the San Antonio River Authority tells KENS 5 Sue Kalberg. KENS 5 is a TV station in San Antonio. Plecos grow rapidly, and can survive out of water for more than 20 hours. The fish has armored skin with no natural predators in Texas. All of these factors combined make their population explode, causing problems for Texas rivers. They take over important habitats such as springs, push out and replace native species, including listed species and species of conservation concern, decimate native vegetation, and undermine and destabilize banks. Gary Garrett, a fisheries scientist and Texas Parks and Wildlife Department's Director of Watershed Conservation, said in a 2011 statement. In no way do they have redeeming qualities. In no way do they have any redeeming qualities, he says. The cost of invasive species in North America has increased in the past 50 years. In the 1960s, invasives cost an average of $2 billion per year. In the 2010s, that number spiked to over $26 billion. Invasives also harm native wildlife, according to the National Wildlife Federation. Approximately 42% of threatened or endangered species are at risk due to invasive species. Scientists suspect the armored catfish may have caused population reductions in a native species called Devil's River minnows that live in San Felipe Creek in Texas, according to a Texas Parks and Wildlife post. The 400 fish collected from the San Marcos River will be euthanized using a fish anesthetic and used for research, specifically population control methods, says Monica McGarity, Texas Parks and Wildlife Department's senior scientist for aquatic invasive species, to Newsweek's Catherine Ferris. They want to look at the age and growth rate of the individuals in the river to get information about popular dynamics, McGarity tells Newsweek. Researchers fitted suckermouth armored catfish in the San Marcos River with tags last year to study their movements, and increase the effectiveness of removal efforts. The fish are not prohibited in Texas, and current management focuses on increasing awareness about not releasing aquarium life, per a Texas Parks and Wildlife Facebook comment. And that article was by Margaret Osborne. Up next, 2,000-year-old Roman bowl discovered intact in the Netherlands. Unearthed in the Dutch city of Nijmegen, not even going to try to pronounce that, the blue glass artifact was in pristine condition. This story by Nora McCreevy. Archaeologists working at a dig in the Dutch city of Nijmegen uncovered a well-preserved 2,000-year-old blue glass bowl late last year, reports Anne Nitschmans for Dutch newspaper De Gelder. The palm-sized dish had survived centuries buried underground, remaining perfectly intact with little or no wear. Researchers and the town government announced the bowl's discovery last week as archaeologists worked to clear the area, part of the city's Winkelstieg business district, ahead of a planned housing development, reports Francesca Atten for the Art Times. The item is distinguished by its pattern of vertical stripes. Such dishes were made by allowing molten glass to cool and harden over a mold, lead archaeologist Pepijn van de Greer tells De Gelder, per Art Times translation. That's a mouthful. The pattern was drawn in the glass mixture. The pattern was drawn in when the glass mixture was still liquid. Metal oxide causes the blue color. Nijmegen is among the oldest cities in the Netherlands, according to the local Radboud University. It may even be the oldest, though several cities claim that distinction. Ancient Romans first established a military camp near the location of present-day Nijmegen in the 1st century CE, around the time of the glass bowl's creation. The settlement expanded and became the first Roman city in the present-day Netherlands, a designation that gave town residents Roman citizenship, according to Art Times. Nijmegen, modern Dutch name, derives from the Latin Noviomagus, meaning new market, its location overlooking the Waal River, Waal, W-A-A-L. The Waal River afforded Roman forces a strategic military advantage and access to trade routes, according to the university. Archaeologists suggest that the blue glass bowl might have been made by Roman artisans or carried by traders, given Nijmegen's unique status as a hub of ancient Roman activity. Van de Greer tells De Gelder that the bowl may have been created in glass workshops in Germany or Italy, making it a valuable commodity for trade. For the residents of the settlement on the Winkelstieg, the bowl had a great value, says Van de Greer, according to Art News. He adds that the residents would have had a great need for leather and liked to buy cattle hides. Researchers at Winkelstieg have also unearthed tombs, dishware, and jewelry, as Jasmine Liu reports for Hyperallergic. Per De Gelder, the team hopes to continue investigating soil samples from an ancient well discovered at the site to learn more about the crops cultivated in the region. As for the bowl, Van de Greer believes the really special artifact deserves a spot in a museum collection, per Hyperallergic. Norma Creevy is a daily correspondent for Smithsonian. She's also a freelance journalist based in Chicago, whose work has appeared in Wired, Washingtonian, and the Boston Globe, New York Times, and others. And our next stories, wolves keep brain worms spreading deer from moose populations in Minnesota. Wildlife managers now face the challenge of creating conservation plans for all three species while maintaining balance between predator and prey animals. And this is by Elizabeth Gamilio. Picture of a huge moose, I believe it is. Let me look closer. Lying in the sun, sunning himself. In Minnesota, moose used to roam the boreal forest by the thousands. The population had 8,800 individuals in 2006. And since then, numbers in the northeastern part of the state alone have fallen by 64%, reports Liz Sheltons for Vox. Warmer, shorter winters, tick infestations, liver issues, wolves, and parasites all contribute to the decline in remnant Minnesota moose populations, reports Dennis Anderson for the Star Tribune. However, the biggest threat may be migrating white-tailed deer. As deer entered moose habitats, they brought brainworm, a fatal parasite, to moose. While harmless to white-tailed deer, the parasite causes disorientation, extreme weakness, and the inability to stand in the moose. It may be a critical factor as why Minnesota's northern moose populations have declined significantly. A study published in Science Advances in December 2021 shows gray wolves may help the moose populations by keeping infected deer at bay. More wolves were linked to less overlap between deer and moose, reducing the risk of parasite transmission, reports John Myers of Twin Cities Pioneer Press. We often think of wolves as bad news for moose because they kill a lot of calves, said study co-author Tiffany Wolf, an expert in veterinary population medicine at the University of Minnesota. But this suggests that wolves may provide a protective benefit to adult moose from parasite transmission perspective. Because brainworm is such an important cause of adult moose mortality in Minnesota, we can now see that the impact of wolves on moose is a bit more nuanced. Warm winters with less snow have made it easier for white-tailed deer to migrate further north. I think that should be farther north. Over the past three decades, gray wolf numbers have exploded due to white-tailed deer ranges expanding into moose territory. Moose catch brainworm from deer poop after snails and slugs on the forest floor consume the deer droppings, and then climb up trees and shrubs where moose tend to forage for food. Once the moose consumes the leaves, eggs hatch inside the moose's brain, and worms tunnel in and out, causing neurological damage. After capturing and tracking 94 adult moose, 86 deer, and 47 adult wolves, they found that the most significant risk of brainworm transmission occurred when deer and moose overlapped during the spring and summer migrations. They also found that deer and moose populations were less likely to overlap when the presence of wolves increased. The study implications may help state and tribal managers draft up wolf management plans in Minnesota. Still, increasing the number of wolves requires a balance. Every 8 out of 10 moose calves born in northeastern Minnesota are killed by the predators in their first 2 weeks of life, meaning fewer calves survived into adulthood to breed. I think if we can agree on an area in the core moose range where we are going to work to benefit moose, and we include deer management and maybe some wolf management to start, along with targeted habitat work, we might succeed. Another author, Seth Moore, wildlife biologist at the Grand Portage Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa, explains to Pioneer Press, we might be able to keep moose in Minnesota. Elizabeth Gamilo is a daily correspondent for Smithsonian and a science journalist based in Milwaukee. She has written for Science Magazine as their 2018 Diverse Voices in Science Journalism intern. Well, good for her. Good. And let's see what's up next. Rare Henry Moore sculpture spent decades sitting on a mantelpiece at an English farm. A lead figurine by the famed British artist could fetch upwards of $70,000 at auction by David Kindy. And in our last few minutes, see how much we can get in here. For decades, a small, unassuming lead statue sat on the mantle of a farmhouse in England, now identified as a previously unknown sculpture by 20th century British modernist Henry Moore. The artwork will go under the hammer in March. It carries an estimate of roughly $40,000 to $68,000, but could fetch substantially more at auction, reports ITV News. When they said go under the hammer, I thought they were tearing it down, but I guess that refers to the gavel hammer for the bidding. Experts at the Henry Moore Foundation and auction house, Drewitz, authenticated the work, which dates to around 1939 or 40 and is entitled Mother and Child. It features an abstract representation of the two figures, per BBC News. The foundation linked the statue to 18 ideas for sculpture, a 1939 Moore sketch in its archives. Drewitz specialist Francesca Whitman tells ITV News that the sculpture is unique and rare, partly because the artist only worked briefly with lead in the 1930s. Moore experimented with the substance along with rope and wire while creating his well-known string sculpture. And that's going to wrap up our time. Hope you've enjoyed today's reading from Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. See you next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast on our website. If you have any comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138.